Hi, this is Ron Dante, lead voice of the Archies, and you're listening to Mr. Media.
Today on Mr. Media, I'll talk to Grammy Award-winning singer Melissa Manchester. Stick around, and please, please, don't cry out loud. This is Bob Andelman, and this is the Mr. Media interview, brought to you today by the Stitcher app for mobile devices. Give it a test drive today at stitcher.com/mrmedia, Mr. Media. I love this free radio app, and I think you will too. stitcher.com/mrmedia. Mr. Media is recorded live before a studio audience of former Blossom cast members who made it as guests on Mr. Media ahead of Melissa Manchester, including Mayim Bialik and Joey Lawrence, in the new media capital of the world, St. Petersburg, Florida. We all know Melissa Manchester's hits. Don't Cry Out Loud is probably the most famous. But the casual listener probably doesn't know much about how she became the singer we all recognize today. And I include myself in that group, although I feel like her work has been one of those soundtracks in my life for the last, oh, who cares how many years it's been, right, Melissa?
Oh, honey, 40 years, and I'm thrilled that this turned into a job of the future.
Well, to get a real flavor, and obviously, folks, you know she's here now, to get a real flavor for this woman's remarkable career, you really have to go back to high school. She's a graduate of Manhattan's High School of the Performing Arts, best known as the school upon which the movie and TV series Fame were based. Now, curiously, she studied acting, not singing there. Okay, now the name-dropping begins. She went on to New York University, and I gotta say, my mother went there too, just FYI, where Melissa, not my mother, took a songwriting class taught by Paul Simon. Of course, my mother met my father at NYU, which kept her from earning a degree for almost 15 years, and, well, okay, about which the less said, probably the better. Let's come back to Melissa. As a singer of commercial jingles, she met two other up-and-coming singer-songwriters in New York City, Bette Midler and Barry Manilow. Now, is this a good time to mention that Manilow's longtime producer, Ron Dante, also the voice of the Archies, was on Mr. Media last year?
No? Yeah.
Oh, it's good to mention. Okay, that's good. That's a good time.
Yeah, sure. That's great.
All right. Well, Melissa then became a backup singer for Midler, which helped launch her as a singer and recording artist in her own right. And the rest you probably do know, including chart-topping songs such as Midnight Blue, Don't Cry Out Loud, and the big hit she co-wrote with Kenny Loggins, Whenever I Call You Friend, which is probably my personal favorite in her catalog. Now, Melissa's here today to talk about her career, of course, but also to bring attention to the California Women's Conference, at which she and Helen Reddy will be among the scheduled performers at the Long Beach Convention Center on September 23rd and 24th. The event is described as a forum for the world's most influential voices, hearts, and minds. I'm guessing my invitation is probably in the mail. Now, you can learn more about it at www.californiawomensconference.com. Melissa Manchester, welcome to Mr. Media.
Thank you very much. A pleasure to be here.
Great to have you. And I know that you want to talk about the California Women's Conference and music, but I got to tell you, when I started doing this show 6 years ago, I never imagined I'd have interviewed one, let alone three stars of Blossom.
That's wild. That's wild. So you have spoken to Mayim and Joey?
They've both been on the show, yeah.
Lovely.
Yeah, that's funny. And I got to ask you maybe one, maybe two Blossom questions, and we'll let you off the hook with that. But
sure.
How did you ever wind up with a recurring role on that show? It just seems kind of unlikely.
Well, obviously the writers and directors had a vision of the arc of Blossom's story, and it needed to be filled out by this mother who abandoned her family and ran off to Paris to become a singer. And I auditioned for the role. I auditioned with Ted Wass, who played the father mm-hmm. and directed several of the episodes, and I'm a producer, and I got the gig.
Must have been some Melissa Manchester fans on that show.
Well, it was really lovely because it was the last season that the late Bill Bixby was directing, and to work with him was really eye-opening. It was fantastic, a real honor. Hmm. And to watch how a show is put together like that, because that was my first experience with a series. And it was thrilling and different, and I learned a lot, and was made to feel very, very at home and comfortable, and it was great. It was a great experience.
I guess maybe the timing of that that opportunity was probably good in your career in terms of giving you that exposure and putting you back out there in a different way.
Couldn't hurt.
Okay. All right. And then the last thing I'm going to ask you about that. I'm just curious if you ever watch The Big Bang Theory and you know, think about Miami.
Of course. Of course. And I'm thrilled that she has done so remarkably well with her life. She has walked a very interesting path. She's a brilliant woman. And that she's returned to television is great. I didn't know that she was going to do that, but it's great.
It's something, isn't it? And she's up for an Emmy Award this month.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I'm so happy for her and proud of her. And, you know, and if she ever left acting, she would instantly become a scientist because that was her field of study.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, maybe.
Well, so let's. I want to come back to show business in a minute, but let's talk for a minute about the California Women's Conference. Why is this event important to you?
You know, that's a reasonable question. With all of the strides and achievements that women have made, particularly since the 1950s, let's say, I think it celebrates. I think we need to, in a yearly way, celebrate those accomplishments, open up networks for women. And I must say, I'm not sure if you know this, but more men this year have bought tickets for this than women, which is really fascinating, because it is a gathering to celebrate accomplishments, network, cheer people on, figure out new ways to, you know, connect with social media and all of that, things that will be good, and, you know, and connect with history. So it's quite a joyful event and very important, I think.
Now, is the timing of it significant this year in terms of being after the Democratic Convention but before the election? Is it a political event?
You know, no, it's not a political event. No. But it's I'm very pleased to be part of it.
Have you attended or participated before?
I have not. I've certainly attended and participated in several marches for women and children's rights, but not this one, so I'm excited about this.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because I wanted to ask you about a little bit about politics, not too much, but that you have marched. Are you concerned about women's rights this year? It's been highly politicized, probably more so, I think, than in some other years.
Yes, women's rights are always politicized, and on certain levels, they're just hot-button issues to galvanize an audience really quickly because candidates don't want to talk about deeper issues, and that stuff just is a gigantic distraction. I think it's just very important for women to keep their eye on the ball of empowering themselves so they can help their families, and if they help their families, they're helping their communities because, after all, it does take a village.
Are women's issues in your mind? Are they? Do they belong to one political party or another, or do they cross boundaries?
No, and to say that they belong to one political committee or group or another is folly. You know, healthy women, healthy families is good for our nation, and that's all I'm interested in, and that's all everybody should be interested in.
Okay. You mentioned marching a minute ago, and I was thinking about that in addition to your performance, Helen Reddy will also be singing at the conference.
Uh-huh.
And
mm-hmm.
Helen is obviously very identified with the women's movement in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
I wondered if you are or were an ardent feminist, and if you did march during that time or burn a bra or any of that kind of stuff.
Well, I didn't burn a bra because I wasn't wearing too many bras in those days. but yes, I marched for the Stand for Children March in Washington. Am I an ardent feminist? Of course I am. I have a daughter, and I have nieces, and I have nephews, and I want everybody to be empowered and strong, and because if everybody's empowered and strong, that means that there are stronger families. That's my belief. And then you raise children who have belief in themselves, belief that success is always possible for them, and that's what the center of the promise of our nation is. And so, am I an ardent feminist? You know, I didn't think about it when I was in my 20s. I was just writing a lot, and then a lot of my songs were sort of taken into the feminist movement. They were used on a Ms. Magazine special. So I was simply writing from my heart, and I didn't identify one way or another. I wasn't a terribly political kid, although I did march, because in New York City, you were just always marching. There was always something to march about. Mm. And so that's sort of the long-winded answer to your question.
All right. Well, let me ask you a totally impertinent question. You raise this something you said. When did you go back? When did you start wearing a bra again? What causes that to happen?
Oh, you know, the autumn chill. In New York, it's the autumn chill. You just put on a bra.
Got it. I miss that look. I grew up in that time in the 70s, and I don't know. I always liked that look. I'm just saying. And at the same time, I have to say, all those bras that did get burned, you know, boy, what a costly and terrible waste that was. Anyway, so let's talk a little bit about music and songwriting. I mentioned that early on you had taken a songwriting class taught by Paul Simon. Mm-hmm. Now, he was someone who has been masterful over the years at writing songs that could seem on the surface like a very simple pop song, what I guess Paul McCartney would have called silly love songs. But they were inevitably layered with politics and social commentary. And I wondered if you felt that any of that, either at the time or over the years, had kind of rubbed off or had been important to your own work.
Well, that's a very fair question, because in the context of when he was writing those songs in particular, the genre of pop song writing, the actual form of the song, was changing because of this first wave of singer-songwriters, Bob Dylan, Paul Simon, Beatles, Carole King, Joni Mitchell. The actual content of lyrics was opening up, and so it was opening up to poetry and psychology and moving into deeper realms other than just Moon, June, Spoon. So what I learned from Paul Simon is that, in essence, is that all the stories have been told. It is the way you tell your story, which is your stamp of authenticity. And as a singer-songwriter, that's all you're trying to do anyway. And, of course, as a songwriter, that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to find your authentic voice, and hopefully it captures something for an audience in such a unique way that you make them feel that you've written this for them alone. And it's a mysterious process, and it's a mysterious effect, and I've never taken it for granted, and the deeper I get into my career and my life, the more precious the currency of song has become.
You make a really good point there. I think that, you know, the stories have all been told. It's how you tell it. It is amazing, to me at least, that we can still turn on the radio or open up iTunes or whatever and hear music that still sounds unique, whether it's the lyric or the melody or whatever it is. It seems impossible, doesn't it?
Well, it's interesting because, if you listen to the history of popular song from the beginning of the form, which was Stephen Foster, what's interesting is that, and Simon wrote about this several years ago in the New York Times, that at some point popular songs would not be melody-driven, which they had been. They would become rhythm-driven, which they are now. And I teach songwriters at USC as an adjunct professor, and it's fascinating because the aesthetic of the popular song today, because it's rhythm-driven, that means that the phrases are much shorter and are repeated and therefore don't get really developed the way they had been when they were melody-driven. But that said, I believe that though things that are rhythm-driven are catchy and make you want to jump and shout and dance and stuff like that, I think that the soul and the heart really yearns for melodies, and people always come back to melodies.
Hmm. I didn't know that you teach, so I'm very curious. I'm very interested in that. Now, are you teaching people to write? I, this is a rhetorical question. Are you teaching people to write like Melissa Manchester, or are you able to teach them to write like themselves, but that there's certain commonalities?
Yeah, no, I have no interest in having anybody do anything that I do. That's you know, that's the path of an artist. You have to find your path and your voice and your story. So what I do is just I teach several things at once. I teach about performance, and I teach about you know, refining songs if that's what they want to bring me. They're really talented kids, and they are taught well in other classes of songwriting at USC as well. And I teach them about what I call the art of conversational singing. And really, I would love to teach this all over the country. I'd love to do master classes or teach seminars. It's so interesting. And I just teach from my very long experience and what I have learned. And to see young ones, you know, sophomores, whatever, at the very beginning, the you know, when you're 20, you think you've, though this is a new voice for you, songwriting and performing, it's all about thinking different thoughts, and I simply share those different thoughts for them because I've played in all of the crappy clubs and I've played in all of the beautiful theaters, and I've survived, and that's what I share with them is how to survive as well as possible.
You know, it's really weird. I had a note to myself to ask you about songwriting because I have a teen daughter who has a real natural flair for music and periodically will write her own music. As a matter of fact, I thought she was asleep the other night and she burst out and said, "I finished my song." I said, "I didn't even know where you were writing a song." So I wondered, you know, what kind of advice you might have for young women, particularly who have an interest in performing or writing or both.
What advice? Well, you know, if you want to do it, then you simply don't take no for an answer and you find ways to do it as much as possible. But you have to find out what it is that really burns your passion. You know, if it's performing in musical theater, that's a very specific track. If you love becoming a club rat and you go from club to club to club and perform at open mic nights or whatever they call it, just so that you can perform and use up that energy through your songs, that's what you do too. But it's very hard to, or if you want to audition for American Idol, I mean, these are all reasonable approaches. The thing that you can't substitute is how time teaches you, how experience teaches you. So that's sort of what I want to share.
And how has your own songwriting evolved over the years? I mean, can you look at something that you wrote earlier in your career and compare it with a more recent composition and recognize your own growth, or do you need other people to be able to see that?
Well, you know, the fact that I'm singing songs that I'd written decades ago touches me because these songs have become monologues. And what is touching is that I still enjoy singing them because they're, I guess, crafted well enough that I can still infuse them with different insights. And that's what you have to do. Otherwise, I guess you would just jump off a bridge from boredom. But I've never been bored by my songs. They've grown with me, and for that I'm very grateful. I mean, I do know of singers who just won't perform earlier songs, whatever. And, you know, that's fine. It's everybody's choice. But I love my songs. I love bringing them along. I love the effect they have on the audience. I love how a song can articulate an unspoken feeling for somebody in the audience. And so, therefore, they come backstage and thank me for speaking their truth and giving them away. Very touching.
But I guess what I'm wondering is, can you see the growth in your style of writing? For example, early in your career, you were writing clearly pop songs. Later in your career, you wrote for theater, for film. And, you know, I'm thinking that there had to be some evolution in your style or your approach to reach those different levels.
Well, there is. I mean, thank you for noticing. You know, I grew up in New York City. I grew up around opera. I grew up a lot of Broadway musical songs because those songs were on the radio. Those were the pop songs of the day. And so I was informed by certain structures. I was informed by a certain breadth of of melody writing, because in those days, songs were written by songwriters for great singers. And that's very different than songwriters singing their own song, because a lot of times they're not great singers. So I just always had that big sensibility of melody and stuff. Are there songs that I could not write anymore today? Yeah, you bet. And they just came out in that initial gush of being a songwriter, where everything is an inspiration for a song. But I'm touched by it all, and I love writing for theater, and I love writing for animation. I've written for Disney. I wrote the great song for The Great Mouse Detective, and I wrote Lady and the Tramp 2. I wrote the score for that. And I've written a musical called I Sent a Letter to My Love, and I'm working on a new musical now with Rupert Holmes. Hmm.
Who's also been on the show, I'll just say.
Oh, yeah, it's lovely. Lovely, yeah.
Nice guy.
And so, yeah, he's a good guy. And so, yeah, it's all just part of the creative impulse to get stuff out when stuff touches you and gloms onto you and nudges you into being expressed somehow. It's all part of the same thing. Performance is part of the same impulse. Singing is part of the same impulse. Writing is part of the same impulse.
And
fascinating.
What about that branch of composing? Writing songs where you work with another person. For example, I mentioned in the introduction that I think my favorite of your catalog is Whenever I Call You Friend with Kenny Loggins, which came at a time certainly in his career, and your careers were kind of parallel. It seemed like everything that he touched for a while there went right to the top. It was just amazing.
Yeah.
And this is a really good song. I just wondered if there's anything about writing with another person or just writing with Kenny that you might recall.
Well, writing with another person is fantastic because by myself I write very slowly. Mm. I write like it's just a very slow process because my internal editor is always on guard for the authentic choice or the lack of the authentic choice, and that's very hard, but it's just the way my songs come out, and I like it that way. That's fine. But working with, having the luxury and the pleasure of working with a collaborator, you actually get stuff done quickly. And working with Kenny was great because we kept meeting each other in those days at televised award events, which were new, and we were frequently paired up to present awards, and we just kept meeting each other in the green room. And he said, he suggested that we try to get together and write a song. And we did, and we wrote Whenever I Call You Friend, and he went off and recorded it with Stevie Nicks. And my record company president never thought the song would do anything, and that's why I never recorded it with him.
Is that right? Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. And he, yeah. I mean... He was, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but that guy at that time, hotter than a pistol. I mean, just...
He was huge, yes, and I could not convince my record company president that that would be a really good idea. I could have convinced my dog that that would have been a good idea, but for some reason he didn't get it. So,
wow.
But anyway, it's, I hope one day for sure that I'll record it with Kenny.
Yeah, that would be great. That would be great.
Of course.
Well, one more question before we have to let you go. The world lost a great composer fairly recently, Marvin Hamlisch, who I think that you knew, and I wondered if you had any thoughts on his work and the kind of the legacy that he left behind.
Marvin was a dear friend of mine, and the anguish of his loss will take a long time to get over, honestly. He and my darling friend Carol Sager gave me the gift of Through the Eyes of Love, the theme from Ice Castle. Mm-hmm. And I had been a guest a year ago this past June at the Pasadena Pops, where Marvin was not only conducting, but he became the musical director. And luckily, I had that filmed. Mm-hmm. So at some point, I will put his conducting of me into my show. But his loss is profound because besides the fact that he was a fantastic gentleman and a dear friend, his musicianship was beyond compare. He could write anything and did. he loved other people's talent and showed it. He really, he was very dear. This past April, he presented me in New York City with a Bistro Award. And it's a loss. It's a loss. And I think as time goes on, his music will become more and more celebrated.
That's very nice. Well, folks, you can see Melissa Manchester perform at the California Women's Conference at the Long Beach Convention Center on September 23rd and 24th. For more information about the event, please go to the CaliforniaWomen'sConference.com. To learn when Melissa will be in concert at a theater near you, you can check out her website, which is www.melissa-manchester.com. People find you on any social media? Do you do Twitter or Facebook, any of that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I have Facebook, and I have my website, and that's what I do.
All right. Well, Melissa Manchester, this is a pleasure to talk to you, and thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Media, today.
My pleasure. Thanks.
You can see and hear almost 1,000 Mr. Media interviews by visiting our main site, MrMedia.com, MrMedia.com. Or check out the more than 200 video interviews on the Mr. Media Radio site on YouTube. And I'd sure appreciate if you'd show some love for Mr. Media's advertisers, including Stitcher. Apple named Stitcher a top 5 news app of 2011. It's a free mobile app for your smartphone or tablet that lets you listen to your favorite shows and discover the best of news, entertainment, and sports on demand. You can listen whenever you want to more than 5,000 shows, get customized recommendations, and discover what your friends are listening to. My own list of Stitcher favorites is pretty eclectic. I start my day with an hour of MSNBC's Morning Joe with Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski. Then it's the latest 2-minute update from the Onion News Network. After that, I'll listen to WTF with Mark Maron, Here's the Thing with Alec Baldwin, HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher, and excerpts from E's Chelsea Lately and The Soup with Joel McHale. Also in regular rotation on my Stitcher playlist, The BS Report with ESPN's Bill Simmons, The TechCrunch Headlines, and The Don Geronimo Show. The latest episodes of each show, whether originating from broadcasts, cable TV, radio syndication, or podcasts, are continuously updated. Stitcher is a free app for your iPhone, iPad, Kindle, Fire, BlackBerry, Droid, and more. And show your support of Mr. Media by getting, did I mention it's free? The app at stitcher.com/Mr. Media. That's stitcher.com/MR Media. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. We're also supported by Audible. Check out Audible's 30-day trial membership and download the audiobook version of the book everyone's been talking about, 50 Shades of Grey by E.L. James. Sign up for your free trial today at audible.com/radio. Again, audibletrial.com/radio. And finally, if you need a disc jockey for a wedding, bar mitzvah, corporate event, or just a big old party, please consider calling 1-800-DIAL-DJS, the party authority for all your party entertainment needs. You can call 1-800-DIAL-DJS or go to their website, 1-800-DIAL-DJS.com, and tell them Mr. Media sent you. And thanks for listening.